we're back. Welcome to Deep Thinking, the motorcycle road racing podcast.
47.
Number 47. If you're listening to other road racing motorcycle road racing podcasts, I'm sure you've got your reasons, however pathetic they might be.
You know, Tony Serra says that ours is the world's greatest.
And when Tony Serra speaks,
everybody listens.
Do you remember the, who was it? E.F. Hutton. E.F. Hutton commercials,
when
right?
E.F. Hutton speaks, everybody listens.
There was a great Saturday Night Live one. Was it, it was a different income tax company, but it was like, reason number 43, you let us do your taxes. We take the time. Reason number 74, we have the time. Why? Reason 94, we're doing time. When it draws back to the guys in a prison cell, it's like we're doing 10 to 25, and we're willing to break the law to get you the lowest
priority.
He's Ed Sorbo from Lindemann Engineering. You can find him on the web at
LE. You know, if they're listening to this podcast, yeah. They've already found my website.
Doesn't matter.
That's where they got
Doesn't
it.
Doesn't matter. Nah, yeah. What if somebody's bootlegged it? What if somebody's torrent shared?
You know what? That'd be kind of cool. We made it to the level where we're being bootlegged.
People are stealing our stuff, right?
le-suspension.com.
I'm Michael Gugis, moto journalist, track day rider, occasional racer. God, man, I just love going fast on bikes. Hey, you know what? as far as it looks like in the pictures, you know what? Dustin Coyner, Mr. Personality, once was giving me shit. And you know what? We remember the people, you know, that annoy us. We remember the things that hurt our feelings, you know? I had a picture taken at Button Willow once for an article I was doing. And I put it up on the website for the guys I was racing with. And Dustin's comment was, Gugis, making slow look fast since whatever. You know, and I thought, you know, that's a really shitty thing to say. But you know what? The photo, if you looked at the photo,
he was jealous.
I looked
like
I was hauling ass, man. Yeah. And that's all that matters to my readers, you know? What are we going to talk about?
We were just yakking about all kinds of shit, and we're like, man, we better turn the recorder on.
Now just
crickets.
I can't remember a thing. Here's one.
We were talking about British Superbike and why is the middle of the field so good.
That's right.
That's what got us started.
That's right. That's what got us started. And here was an observation. British Superbike is now in their title shootout, you know, where they take everybody's points. It's like the NASCAR chase for the cup thing. At the end of the season for the last few races, they take the top six guys, basically get them all at the same level, and now it's a six-race shootout for the championship.
Because the idea of racing for a championship throughout that's not cool enough.
Not cool enough. Okay. You know, it's just one of those, God things. But anyway, British Superbike, if you listen to, read the knuckleheads on the internet, they call it the greatest superbike series in the world. And, you know, granted, it's a healthy superbike series. It really is. But what Ed and I were talking about was why it looks that way. Because when you look at the front of the field, it looks no different than any other racing series. At one point, I think it was last year or the year before, I can't remember which it was, but I was counting. MotoGP and World Superbike both had more different winners, than British Superbike. And especially if you count their dry races, it's only a couple of guys who win British Superbike races. And some of them, I mean, the last few have just been total runaways. Josh Brooks, they finally, Yamaha got their R1. That's what we're going to talk about Yamaha, too. Yamaha got their R1, dialed down to British Superbike specs. And that thing's a freaking missile, you know? Shaky
it's a
Burn,
good bike.
Yeah, Shaky Burns going, what the hell happened? But the thing that makes British Superbike so interesting in comparison to a lot of other series is that they've got 30 people on the grid all the time. They've got, you know, not professional riders, but guys who aren't amateurs, and
they didn't have to add super sport to fill the field.
Exactly. And we were talking about how do you fill in the midfield? How do they fill in the midfield?
It's the same thing that leads to more people riding motorcycles in England than ride them here. And that's a cultural thing, and it's an economic thing, and it's a distance you have to travel thing.
Right.
And we talked about this before, that recovering from World War II had a big part to play in this.
Right.
Because, You needed a way to get to work, and a motorcycle is a heck load cheaper than a car. And right. In England, in fact, they had a whole bunch of different versions of three-wheel
cars.
Death trap we, cars.
Did you see the one on, what was it, Top Gear?
That's how I learned about these cars. I couldn't imagine that anybody would really build something like
right,
that.
You saw that clip, and you thought this has got to be a joke.
Right? So then, whatever the population in England is, a much bigger percentage of those people like motorcycles than who like motorcycles in America. So you start from a bigger pool of people, and you got more riders, and you got more racers, and you got more corner workers, and more of everything.
Yep.
And so that means that you're going to have a lot more of regular guys, right? Because basically the top guys are going to be the superhumans, and they're going to have the superhuman team,
right?
And then you're going to have all the regular guys who have normal human skills and normal, you know, mechanicking skills and normal amount of time they can spend on it.
Right.
But there's however many of these guys there are, there's more than they fit on the grid, right? And so the grid's full.
And you've got companies that have people in them, people who have money, who are like, they don't think motorcycle, oh my God. Yeah. They think, hey, that's kind of cool.
There's a lot more people who are like, well, motorcycles are interesting and maybe I'm only going to get a tax write-off for helping my buddy out, but it's still
cool.
But
what the heck?
I like it.
Right?
I get to hang out and play the role of the sponsor.
Exactly.
They
show me a Photoshop bike with my company's name on the side, and I go, who's
you
your
got,
daddy?
You got more riders, you got more racers, you got more participants, you got more sponsors, you got more clubs, you got more of everything, and that just leads to the fat part of the middle field.
Exactly. There's a couple of other things, but if I could do a brief diversion, that whole wartime recovering from the economy thing, you look at Formula One now, and the majority, I mean like 7/8 of the teams are based in England.
Yeah.
But you look at Cooper and the post-war explosion of Formula racing in England, and it was little cars, 500cc twins. You know, and you huge fields of them because they were dirt cheap, and it just started that momentum.
There's multiple reasons for that, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, Germany was more destroyed, Europe was more destroyed than England was at the end of the war, for whatever reasons, English speaking was one of the things that made it more teams easier. So you get some nucleus of what's going to be
a critical mass, right?
And then like pretty soon, well, if you want to have a team, then you need to be based in England because that's where the crankshaft guy is, and that's where the engine case guy is, and blah 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 blah. And it grills this critical mass, and you just get more and more of it. And then England's close enough to Europe.
Yeah.
There's a fucking train now. You jump on a train,
right,
to get there.
There's a million racetracks.
It's easy. Yeah, exactly.
You know?
It's a good culture for it.
Exactly.
And English is the world language
for business.
So if you're doing business and you're doing sponsors, okay, it's just going to be a little harder if you're doing it in German or if you're doing it in French. And so if you're doing it in English, well, then you might as well be in England. And you're that much closer to America, where there might be crazy resources
might
and
be a little more
whatever
money.
You know, I don't know all the details of why, but the answer is always some version of something started. There was the grain there, and it grew into a pearl. And now you just have to go there.
Now it's it becomes a self-perpetuating thing, you know, the accumulation of knowledge. I talked to some guys at Bell Helmets a few years ago, and they were talking about, I was asking, where are you manufacturing? And they said, China. Everybody manufactures helmets in China, with the exception of the really high-end ones that are, you know, hand-laid and that sort of thing. The really, you know, the mass-produced ones are there because that's where all the technical know-how on how to make a helmet is now. You know, that's if you want to talk to somebody who knows how to mass produce a helmet, you got to call China. There's something else that happened in British Superbike that I think is kind of interesting too, because it's like you said, it's the base, it's the culture that supports it. Racing is cool, and to a large group, motorcycle road racing is cool to a large group of people. And the other thing, and the reason that I think this is interesting is Triumph doesn't race in the Superbike class. Triumph doesn't build a superbike, but the rules makers there have made the 675 competitive, if not a little dominant, in the middleweight classes. And then they had for a long time a Triumph 675 spec series. I'm not sure if it's still there or not, but I mean, so you've got the local manufacturer all over the grid, the paddock.
Well, check it out. If you have a shop in America and you jump on your race bike and you zoom down the back street and you get caught, you're going to be in trouble.
Right.
Probably didn't even get arrested.
Right.
And the odds that some neighbor is going to complain about you, what do you think those odds are compared to somebody in England complaining, right? So it's a lot of little things, right? But it adds up,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So I was at Vegas for the last We're Around,
right?
2 weeks ago, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And this old British guy walks up to talk to me. And he knew me from racing 250s, and he had a bunch of 250 stories, and we were yakking. And he's,
are we going to identify this gentleman?
I don't remember his name. He knows himself, but
you know who you are. Send us Hickory Farms.
He was talking about one of his injuries, and he grabbed his left arm and he moved it, and it looks like he has a
like
an extra elbow in the middle between his elbow and his shoulder. I didn't want to look too closely. It was kind of creepy.
Oh Jesus!
And he was really funny because he's like me. He starts telling a story. And then he thinks of something else. It reminds him of a different story. And he switches to that story and then completely forgets what he was trying to say in the first place.
Oh, my God.
But he rode road races in England, street races. And he rode closed circuit road racing all over the place. So I asked him, what's the difference between when you ride on a road course and when you ride on a road racing course?
Okay.
I forgot to start the
timer.
Yeah,
you did. It's okay. We're 11 in. We're still
halfway.
Good. Yeah.
And he said, great question, and then he told a story, and I had to bring him back after a little while.
He probably started playing with his arm, and you passed out for a little while.
But he basically said, you know, more or less, you're riding at 90% when you're racing on the roads, and 100% on the courses. But he didn't say it specifically that way. He kind of mumbled and hemmed and hawed through it and whatever. Anyway, it was just an interesting conversation, but it points to what we're talking about is that there's a culture of racing there, and so there's more, and it goes, it's better in so many ways, including the part where the constable
right,
would say, Mr. Sorbo, you know you're not supposed to do this
here,
right?
You're supposed
now
to do it over.
Could you please at least put a muffler on the
exactly
bike, right?
Exactly. Would you know? Mind terribly?
What's the name of the guy from Tech 3 with the crazy hair?
Oh, the Guy Colon?
Yeah. So he built a six-cylinder something in his off time just so that he can hear the sound of it.
Right.
And there's a video you can find on the internet of them starting it up and driving it around the parking lot. Can you imagine that guy getting hauled away for that? Not a chance.
Not a chance.
But if he did it here, they'd
right?
call him a terrorist. Right?
Well, you know, that hair.
He'd have to be going like, my Second Amendment rights allow me to make all the noise I want with all the six-cylinder motorcycles I can build to get off here. So, yeah,
you know,
it definitely, it's different there.
And it's funny. We're going to talk about road racing a little bit here. And it just reminds me, I was doing, I can't remember why I was doing some research on it anyway. Isle of Man, you know, they don't have a national speed limit. There's no
they
national.
They don't need one.
Well, you know, actually, no. If any place on the planet actually could use a speed limit, it's probably them. But I was talking to a guy.
I think their way of dealing with that is more Darwinian.
Right?
It's like, you want to go speed?
You go right ahead.
You're going to be dead.
We'll fish your bike out of the ocean and sell it. We'll leave you there to feed the fish. So I was talking to a guy who raced there, and he only did it once. He's been there a number of times, but he raced there once. And he said, I will never forget. He says, forget how dangerous the racing is. It's the lunatics that are out there on the roads the rest of the time that will scare the crap out of you.
On the days when you can, the regular just, folks
no,
can
just,
go ride.
Just like regular riding, like on Sunday morning. He said, they practice in the evenings. The roads are open during the day, and then they go through a process of shutting down the roads. And I was ready to go. He says, I'm ready to practice. And they say, we're on a delay. And he says, why? And he said, they told him that so many people had crashed that afternoon that the hospital was full. And if any of the racers crashed, there was no place to put them. It's like, holy crap. What a bunch of lunatics.
That's a new reason for a race delay.
You know, Jesus.
Yeah, but, well, it's definitely a different atmosphere, a different culture,
mm-hmm.
You know. And, of course, the people of the Isle of Man, they know that that's their bread and butter.
Oh, yeah,
so they're not dumb.
Yeah.
You know, I'm wondering, though, how long, because it used to be it was once a year thing.
Right.
Now it's twice a year because they have a separate amateur
the Manx thing, right? Right, Manx GP.
And I mean, at some point, people are going to get tired of inviting strangers into their house and all of that other stuff. So they want to be careful not to destroy that thing.
And I keep wondering, and every now and then you read people talk about, well, how many fatalities is it going to take before?
It doesn't matter.
What a lot of people don't know is that what you hear about the Isle. But that's only one of the international road races. Yeah. And then there's a whole series of national road races.
You know, everybody who's getting killed there is an adult who signed up totally knowing what they wanted to do and all of that stuff. So, just because people die skydiving isn't going to prevent skydiving from happening.
You know what the thing that trips me out, though? And these are the thoughts that keep me out of the good schools. That and some pictures that were taken in my 20s, but we don't want to talk about those. I'm dead serious. If everybody like today was walking around with a smartphone with a video camera on it when I was in my 20s, I would not be a college professor.
You know, if that were true, right, all people would already be behaving better. And it hasn't happened.
It's because it's the 18 to 21 year olds are acting like idiots because they don't know any better yet.
We'll find out later.
We'll find out later. They're going to be like, you can think of it in 20 years.
Nobody's going to be able to run for president.
Nobody's going to have a job. You know, I'd like to work for your company. Let me pull up this YouTube video of you. Is that you there with the honey on the nipples?
I see people with tattoos working all the time. Apparently those predictions turned out to be false.
The nurse that was working on my dad, I mean, that dude was just tatted. And on the other hand, it was all religious iconography. So I can kind of see where they might have let that go, but it was a little...
You'd be worried if the nurse who's working on you had a skull with blood dripping off.
Death before dishonor, something like that. Off the patients,
But I tell you what, if you're bleeding out in your unit and your Marine... your Navy medic is putting a tourniquet on you. You don't care what tattoo he has.
Oh, no, you don't care. You don't care who's trying to save your life at that point, right? So here's the thing that I was thinking about. Like I said, these are the sorts of thoughts that keep me out of the good schools. We accepted, up until 1967, Isle, or an open road race, was part of the World Championship. Yes. And we accepted those risks. Mostly because we didn't have any alternatives.
Well, define the we, because you and I weren't around then.
No, the rider, racers who were doing it understood the risks.
It started as road racing.
Right.
And it evolved into closed circuit racing because of all of those reasons. And then you were being forced to go to the one remaining road course as part of the circuit. And it was, compared to the others, it was horribly heavy, and then they stopped doing it.
Right.
Yes.
So...
the bikes were getting a lot faster.
Yeah.
Ooh. And the bikes got faster before the gear got better.
Right.
And now, the bikes are still crazy stupid fast. The gear's a lot better. It's not going to help you if you crash into a wall at 100 miles an hour. But it's not part of a series. It's, you choose to go to this one-off event.
So I get the idea that there's a rush on a road event that you simply will not get on a circuit. But the question is this. How much more of a thrill do you really need beyond circuit racing?
If you're
racing?
Asking that question, then you're not a person who's ever going to do it.
Absolutely.
I'm not going to do it. I mean, it just doesn't blow my skirt up to think about taking that much risk and not being able to ride as fast as I can go. Right? I get it that there's sections on the mountain. I mean, we watched the V for Victory video with Joey Dunlop.
Right.
And he's got one lean angle and one constant speed for 3 minutes, exactly. Right? And the world is just, he's close to the right, then he's close to the left, then he's close, and he knows he can connect all these corners together, and he's just sitting there, hardly doing any work. Right. I don't know if it's pinned, but it's quite fast. And I get it, it's a challenge, right? But the challenge I want, the reason I go to race, is to ride at the freaking limit of the tire and the surface and the track, not at the limit of how much runoff room I have. I want that to be not part of my consideration.
Ed, it's more proof of your genius because you agree with me.
Well, it's a cultural thing. You grow up with road racing, and you dig that idea, and your father does it, and you think that's the cool thing. Okay. Also, remember, here we don't have the option.
No, we could.
You can go to the Pikes Peak bullshit thing once a year.
Right.
And you can ride in the dark in the morning, in the dark in the evening, and it is bullshit.
I've seen people try to do road course stuff. Where was it?
Steamboat Springs in Colorado. Springs and a couple of other. But yeah. Those courses are all just stupid hay bale things.
Yeah.
And you can't ride fast. It's and they've stopped. Look at how little rally racing goes on in America.
Yeah.
Americans are just not into that.
Yeah.
You know? I think part of it is we don't think it's cool that our wall was knocked down by the equivalent of Rossi. We're like, but I know my wall was knocked down.
Exactly.
Yeah, but Rossi did it. Exactly. Yeah, but you don't get it. I had a wall.
Tell Rossi to get his ass out of the hospital and start laying some brick over here.
But check it out. We play baseball and basketball and football. We don't play very much soccer.
Right.
I mean, it's cultural differences are cultural differences. And thank God. If everybody was an American, we'd be really messed up.
No, I agree. It's just funny. I and this is a personal thing. I'll grant it. Are we close?
We're getting close.
Okay.
But I'm gonna have to put these reading glasses on.
Okay.
Time for the 2-minute board.
Okay. I'll wrap it up with this. It's a personal thing with me.
You were gonna wrap it up with this one.
I'm gonna wrap this part up, and then we're gonna get to the 2-minute
board.
You're
gonna wrap up the wrapping.
You and I have both talked to guys who raced at Big Willow, fastest road in the West. And they've talked about getting a super bike through turn 8. I mean, you know, it's sliding, the rear wheel is spinning, you're flying. You're just going as fast as you can. And I'm trying to, this is me personally, I have a difficult time trying to fathom what more I could possibly want from riding a motorcycle at speed than an experience like that.
Well, that's the thing that's neat about all stuff. Unless you go do it, you never get to know, right?
Yeah.
And anybody who's been in a war will tell everybody who hasn't been in a war, dude, you can't do it unless you get it.
Right.
Parents will tell people who don't have kids.
Children, you're not me.
Married people will tell people who are dating, it's not the same. And all the people who haven't done the thing yet are all like, they're crazy.
Exactly.
How different?
How hard can it be to be married? Yeah, right?
We'll never know. And the only way to know is to go do it. But if you don't want to go do it, well, then
you're never going
to
do it.
You can talk to your buddies.
There's a lot of, and there's also a lot of just becoming acclimated to the danger. I was telling I was in school today.
You were going to wrap this up.
We are. But we're taking another brief diversion, but it's a brief one. I've skydived, okay? First time, one of the most exciting things I ever did in my life. I mean, I was on a Cessna 172, and you have to grab the strut on the wing and kind of walk your way out, right? I'm telling you, and they're just looking at me like, you have lost your mind. Second time I did it, one of the most boring things I ever did. I knew the chute was going to pull up over my head, right? And then...
Well, let me pack your chute.
Yeah, well, no, I'm not crazy. I'd pull the ripcord and just a stream of Hickory Farms.
There you go.
Just sausages and cheese.
I was thinking of confetti.
Sausages and cheese. No, it would be much more sarcastic if it was just sausages.
Because you wouldn't be able to grab it and eat it in time.
Son of a bitch. Yeah. And I would be thinking, well, I don't want to die on an empty stomach. Maybe I can get one of these down.
Well, everybody who falls out of an airplane dies.
Right. I know, right? But, you know... That's the sort of logic that gets you to the point of, who told me to put a seatbelt on? Why is the government? I know a guy who survived a crash without a seatbelt. Yeah, you know, and I know that there are people who fall out of planes without parachutes and they live. That does not
that's
sound like
them, I think. It does not.
Odds are that's not the high yield maneuver. All right, here's our 2-minute board. I just wanted to give a shout out to a guy that I know that I just think did something really cool. His name is Mike Pond. He runs Tune Industries. If you read the Shops article on him in Road Racing World, Mike had a successful career. Just wanted to be involved in racing. Put together a team. And they've raced at the AMA level, and they won in New Jersey. And I just think it's just kind of cool when somebody's chasing their dream, manages to get a little bit of level of success. And once again, we've talked about any win, anywhere, anytime. The thing about racing is that it never had to happen. It never had to happen. And no matter what else happens in Mike's career, he's got a number one trophy on his mantle. I just think that's really cool.
The beauty of racing is that it's a meritocracy. Mm-hmm. Right? It's a meritocracy. So your merit determines the level of success.
Oh, to a point.
Well,
to a point. There's also pure luck.
You don't win a race at a national level
granted,
by pure luck.
No, no.
You have to make a plan. You have to execute that plan. You have to work hard for a long time. It doesn't happen overnight.
But this is what I mean. Bad luck and bad circumstances
can happen.
They can keep you from getting that.
But not, if you have a good plan and you work hard, bad luck cannot keep you down forever. Bad luck runs out.
In the same category, Joe Roberts.
Thank you. Had a couple seasons that didn't go very well. Early on, he had some fantastic seasons. And the end of this year, he turned it around, had a dominant race at New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Another example of sticking to your plan, working hard.
Working through
always
it.
Always pays off.
Because you know what? When you're coming up in this industry, it's like going on a ladder. It's like climbing up a ladder. And if you miss a rung, you rarely get a chance to grab that rung again. You know, it's you're usually out of the game, and it's props
well,
to him.
It's not a good financial decision to do this, but it can lead to satisfying results. He's Michael Gugis.
He's Ed Sorbo. Aloha.